Hello and welcome to Conversations. Thanks to Anne Jones for minding the shop for the past couple of weeks. And it's that time of year when we look back at some of our favourite guests, our most popular guests. And we had quite a list made up from our own suggestions and the comments that you've sent to us by email and on Facebook. Today, it's Julianne Bell. Julianne Bell was born blind. She doesn't have radar, but she does have a kind of sonar. Julianne uses tongue clicks to locate objects in the near distance by the noise that they make when they ping the echo back to her. Now, if that sounds vague, it's not. Flash sonar, as it's called, allows her to move through a landscape with a confidence that can be really quite shocking for people who can see. Julianne Bell is a busy person. She's got a family, she runs her own business. She also has a master's degree in music, in conducting choral music. And learning flash sonar has given her the freedom that she always craved and the confidence to travel the world on her own. Hi, Julianne.
Hi, Richard.
What noise do you make to echolocate?
Like you said, it's a very simple tongue click. And I'm using what we will call a palatal click. The speech pathologists out there will know that the palate, or the hard palate, the roof of the mouth, so I'm using my tongue against the roof of my mouth. Some people use different clicks, but my preference is the palatal click.
It's a real sharp click. I don't think yes. I could do it that sharp. If I do it, if I go, it's a bit, that wouldn't work for you as well, would it?
No, the sharper the better, because we want a very short, sharp, distinct sound, but you could do it with practice. We talk about things like, imagine that you are trying to get peanut butter off the roof of your mouth. So if you imagine that, and you can sort of get a sense of clicking that way.
Oh, okay, that's a bit better.
Almost as better already.
Okay, well right. Done. You need to make a little vacuum or something in your mouth. Is that it? Is that part of it?
I suppose. I do it so naturally now, I hardly think about it. The idea is one short, sharp sound. So what we might call a negative click, when people go, isn't going to work because it's quite sloppy. And the clicks that people use with horses, I can't do it. That sort of click doesn't work because it's very sloppy. So you want something fairly high frequency and fairly sharp.
Do you get a picture of a landscape with sort of like fuzzy, shapeless lumps, or is it more specific than that?
It is more specific. You can tell the difference between a fence line and a brick wall, for example. So if you echolocate, if you stand in the one spot and scan with your head and really take note of an object, you can tell where the gaps are within the object. So if you've got a wooden fence with gaps, you can echolocate the paling and the gap.
Oh, the gap between the palings?
Yes, you can. I don't have the same level of skill as some of the people who taught me, but the more you practice it, the better refined it becomes.
And when you're in a landscape and you're doing the clicking, mm-hmm. are you building up a kind of mental map in your mind, a 3D map of the environment as you're doing it?
Yes, definitely. I mean, people who don't use flash sonar would also be doing the same thing, but they're doing it in a different way. We think that this is a quicker way to do it, and we think that this allows us to gain information when we want it. So we choose when we click. So we choose when we want to interrogate the environment and ask it a question and get an answer from it. So we're in control of the information we receive.
And when you're using echolocation, are you focusing on objects or the spaces between them?
Absolutely, focusing on the spaces between. When you have to demonstrate this for media, particularly for television, they want you to echolocate and find objects, because that's much more interesting than finding a blank spot. And so what we have to do is reverse engineer what we do, because I'm not interested in finding all of the light poles on the street. I'm interested in not finding the light poles on the street. I'm interested in navigating such that I don't have to encounter all of the light poles or the trees or the wheelie bins on the street.
Can you tell what an object is made from?
You can. Yes, you often can. Things that are metallic give quite a ping when they echo back at you. Anyone can do this. If you stand in front of something, say a corrugated iron shed or a corrugated iron wall, and if you clap your hands in front of it, you'll hear the corrugated iron sort of sing back at you. And we're able to do that probably to a more fine degree with various textures. So shrubbery is going to sound different to the trunk of a tree. I can, on a good day, I can distinguish trees with perhaps a wall behind them or a fence behind them. So you can hear the layers of the landscape in that one simple click and echo response.
Of course, your biggest enemy then would be ambient noise, wouldn't it? Traffic.
Can be, yes.
And wind, I suppose.
Wind is something I dislike intensely because it can sometimes even distort where the sound is coming from. So wind can be an issue. Wind's an issue for a lot of people in a mobility sense because it can even blow you a little bit off your course of direction. So wind is not our favourite thing.
Does it look a bit uncanny to people who are sighted when they see you using it and walking down the street?
Yes, it seems to make people very uncomfortable. When I was at my peak and I was doing it very well, I've had a couple of accidents since I learned to echolocate and my walking speed has decreased. But when I was doing it at my peak, I would literally be purposefully striding down the street or down the mall or down some place that I was very comfortable with. And people would physically stop me. They would physically touch me and say, "Are you all right?" And I remember asking one lady if I was bleeding from somewhere that I didn't know because I couldn't genuinely understand why she was asking me this. I wasn't sort of standing, you know, the way people stand and look lost and think, "Oh, where are you?" I was moving with great purpose, and yet people will stop you and ask if you're okay because I'm not with someone. And that makes particularly Australians feel very uncomfortable.
You know, I'm being struck as we're having this conversation. It's kind of an irony here. Like, I'm asking you what it's like to click your way through the world mm-hmm. like it's a sense I don't have. Mm-hmm. Does that irony strike you at times? Like, I'm saying, what's it like? It's almost like I'm asking you, like a blind person might ask what a sighted person
yes,
what colour is.
Absolutely. It's the same sort of question, really. And it's if I asked you what colour was, you would try to find words to explain it. But it wouldn't really do colour justice. And I think it's a little bit like that for us too. There's some really great science, you know, that tries to explain it, but even then it doesn't give you that lovely kinesthetic sense of what it's like to move through the world like I do.
You know, I have this experience sometimes. I don't play video games like I used to, but, you know, 3D real-time games, you can move through an environment. And after a while, you get this really interesting mental map in your head of the environment and all the passageways and the rooms and the spaces. They're quite discreet.
Yep.
I don't know if you can know what I'm talking about or know what that's like, but does it sound a bit like what you have to some degree?
Yes. I think the important thing is that flash sonar doesn't work in isolation. So a blind person still needs to use a long cane or a guide dog or some other mobility aid. And a blind person still needs to develop good spatial awareness. So flash sonar will help me work out what's around me at this very moment, but it won't help me remember what was around me 3 metres ago. So you've still got to develop those spatial skills. And like in the world in general, blind people are just a cross-section of the regular community, and there'll be some who have good spatial skills and some who don't. There's a bit of anecdotal evidence to suggest that people who have survived retinoblastoma, which is cancer of the eye, cancer of the retina, have excellent spatial awareness. We don't have any data on that, but the more children we work with and more children and adults we work with RB, we see that their spatial skills are extremely enhanced. We don't know why.
Tell me about the condition that caused you to be blind.
I have Leber's congenital amaurosis, which we call LCA for short, for obvious reasons.
Yes, it's an unlovely name, isn't it?
Look, it's not romantic, it's not poetic.
Right.
But essentially my retinas don't function. I had an electroretinogram when I was 20 because I didn't actually have a proper diagnosis until then. That involved having electrodes put on my face and fed into my eyes, which was not holiday fun by any means. And my retinogram was flat. So there was no response from my retinas at all. Leber's is a really interesting condition. It's genetic in nature, so it's recessive. So both my parents handed me a faulty gene from the same gene pair. So I have one pair of genes that's faulty. Leber's can present on several different genes. And depending on the strain that you have, you can have other side effects. I'm very lucky. I only have a vision impairment. You can get people who have autism along with a vision impairment, kidney problems, you know, seizures can often occur with Leber's. So I consider myself to be extremely lucky that all I have is a vision impairment.
Were you born blind?
Yes.
And how did your parents realise? What point did they realise you were blind?
I think they knew fairly quickly I wasn't doing all the things that little babies do, so I wasn't focusing on faces. I wasn't reaching out for things unless they were auditory. And so I think it was very obvious to them that there was at least something wrong with my eyes. The information that I have is that my family weren't formally told about my blindness for several months. I'm not certain of that information, but that's the information I have. But yes, they were then told that I had no vision, no light perception, nothing.
Was there ever any hope you'd regain your sight?
No. Well, at that point, they didn't know what was wrong. This is the early 70s that we're talking about, and CAT scanning, CT scanning, was almost science fiction back then. And they wanted to do a CT scan, which would have involved an iodine injection. And we really didn't have a lot of data back then as to the dangers of doing that on a new baby. And my parents very rightly asked, well, is this something you're going to do so you can give her her sight? And they said, oh, no, we're not imagining that. We just want to know a bit more about the situation. And Mum and Dad said, well, no, thanks, because they weren't prepared to risk the child they already had. So I didn't have the requisite CT scan or any other testing until I was 20, and I sought out the information myself.
How did your parents decide to deal with it? Were they super protective?
No, they treated me the same way as my siblings. My dad was always the sort of person who researched things, so he learned as much as he could about blindness. He learnt Braille, very early Braille. He didn't follow it up as I got older, but he did certainly learn the basics when I was little. And they tried as best they could to integrate me into their busy family and treat me as they would any of their other children.
As a baby, do you miss those kind of things that we normally measure as developmental milestones for a baby's development?
Yes, we now know that this is super important. So one of the reasons that sighted babies do things is because they see the world beyond them and they want to access it, they want to reach out into it. Blind children don't do that. And if you're fed and if you're played with and if you're loved, then what motivation do you have to do anything? This is still a philosophy in my life, really. But I wasn't sitting at the right age, and I certainly wasn't pulling up or crawling or doing any of those things. So I had to have some physiotherapy. And we had, I think it was several months of physiotherapy, and it was several days a week for several hours a day. So it was a very intense period of physio. But once I started to develop, I caught up very quickly. So by the time I was 15 months old, I'd absolutely reached appropriate milestones and was on track.
How adventurous did you suddenly become?
I was a climber, and we in different places where we live, I have memories of, I'm going to call them, I don't know if they're bay windows, but they were windows that reached almost to the floor. So they might have a sill that was maybe an inch or two high. And I really did not differentiate between a window and a door. So I was quite happy to just climb straight out a window. And this was before the days of fly screens. And we had to make rules that if there was a step up to something, it was not a door. That was a window. And we had to make rules that I wasn't allowed to climb out of them.
Yeah, so you call babies like that climbers. I call them plummeters, Julianne. And yes.
But I thought climbing was excellent. I didn't really have any fear back then, and I would climb anything I could, really.
When did you come to understand that you were blind or just, you know, different from other people?
It's hard to pinpoint that. I know that by the time I was at school, I knew about it. I started school when I was 4 going on 5, so I was quite young. I remember being at preschool in Townsville. We lived in Townsville. My dad worked there for a period of time. And I have very strong memories of going to a regular preschool. And I have very strong memories of my two teachers. I don't remember the other children, but I have very strong memories of things being just a little bit different for me then. I don't know why they were different or how, but I have a memory of that. I started school at a school for the blind. It was called Narbathong School for the Visually Handicapped back then. I cringe as I say that. We don't like words like handicapped anymore in Australia. But I knew then, of course, that I was blind because the other children were blind or had partial vision.
Do you think the strand of Leber's, the condition you were born with, that you had, gave you an advantage in your learning and your understanding?
Again, there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that people with certain strands of this condition are fairly intelligent and have fairly good language skills. and have fairly good adaptability skills, so we can transfer information from one situation to another. Lots and lots of blind children and adults, for that matter, struggle to do that. They struggle to be able to take information and cross-pollinate, if you will, with other situations without a lot of support and input to do that.
Kids who are dyslexic typically develop these really strong interrogative skills to compensate.
Yes.
I think all of us like to think that blind people have all these powerful compensatory skills. Is that true?
It's not true that they come by magic. I would really like to be Daredevil. That would be fantastic. They come with training and development. I've worked with some blind children who are really average listeners. And I spend a lot of my time saying, you really want to lift your game because this is what you've got. I work with blind children who are too busy talking to listen. And so those listening skills, those mapping skills, those memory skills, they come with training. It, you know, use it or lose it. It still applies even when you have a disability. And yes, the visual cortex in the brain is certainly used and it is taken over by other areas of the brain. But again, we know now with the plasticity of the brain that that doesn't just happen passively. It happens through active stimulation of that area.
Yeah, you work on deficits. That's the big thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Not, don't work to go the workaround, work on your deficits.
Yes.
What kind of skills was this specialised school for the quote-unquote visually handicapped able to give you, Julianne?
Well, the most important skill was learning Braille. I would have Braille lessons every day. I was in a class with 9 partially sighted children. I know partially sighted isn't the correct term if you're in Australia. I want to move to the UK because they say it all the time. But back then it was the term, partially sighted, and 2 totally blind children, myself and a boy. And every day myself and my friend would go to the library to a beautiful lady, and she would teach us Braille while our main classroom teacher would work with the sighted children on their writing. And we learned to read Braille. And we learned to write Braille on a Perkins Braille machine, still use those today. And it was the beginning of opening up the world of books to me. So it was absolutely the silver bullet, I think, Braille, for my education.
You were the first blind child to be integrated into a regular primary school in Queensland. Was that a new way of thinking? It obviously was a new way of thinking at the time. I mean, I think these things are more commonplace now, aren't they? But
yes.
Was this considered a bit of a revolutionary act by your parents?
Look, it was. And my poor parents just wanted me to have the opportunity to go to the same school as my sisters. They didn't want me to have to travel in a taxi with a whole lot of other children for 45 minutes a day each way. They wanted me to travel 5 minutes up the street with my sisters and go to school in the same place where the people that I played with in my neighbourhood went to school. For them, it was as simple as that.
Were your parents told off about that?
Oh, yes. My parents were given a really hard time by the powers that be at the time. There was a thought that it was better to keep blind children centralised. And I can understand that from a resource point of view. Let's keep all the children where the resources are. But my parents could see that there were so many valuable lessons that I wasn't going to learn unless I was able to mix with my peers.
You see, this is the thing. I think a while ago I might have thought the same thing. Mm. I'm sort of on this learning curve with all this, Julianne. I'm sort of trying to figure out that really kind of everything I know about this stuff has kind of been wrong in the past, and I think maybe a lot of us are like that.
Sure. I think you're probably right. I think now with the rise of the internet and social media, we all think we know pretty much everything about everything, don't we? And the wonderful thing is to find out that you don't, because then if you find out and you decide that you don't know something, then you've got something to learn. And I hope that the day I stop learning is the day I die, because learning to me is what keeps me going. Blindness is not what you think it is. It's not darkness. It's not dimness. It's not sadness. You know, the most common response when someone finds out I'm blind is, oh, what a shame. And it's so difficult for me not to let that response make me angry, because there's nothing shameful about my life and about the way that I live my life. It's a very full and rich life. And I don't think, if you gave me the chance, that I'd have it any other way.
How much of your life is dealing with the anxiety of sighted people?
Pretty much any time that I'm not by myself, there's always someone to deal with and someone to put at ease, whether it be, I mean, even friends. And I think that becomes the thing that's hard. People who know you for a long time can still say and do things that are just stunning. I have coffee with a friend and she's constantly moving my coffee cup because she doesn't like where it is on the table. To her mind, it's too close to the edge of the table. And I've put it there and she moves it. So we play this game. She moves the cup and I kind of try to look at her as best I can and move it back. And then she kind of moves it again. And it's an awkward game and we need to stop playing it. But essentially, she can't accept that I have an understanding of the space in front of me on the table and that I'm comfortable where I've placed my cup.
Oh, my God. This is what we do with toddlers.
Yes, it's exactly what we do with toddlers and old people.
Yeah,
toddlers and old people, we do it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty terrible. I think sometimes I think the presence of a blind person on the bus or on the street makes us, the sighted people of this world, feel anxious because the worst thing you can imagine is if that person fell over,
yep.
I would feel awful. I would just feel terrible. But it's no worse than someone with sight falling over, is it?
No.
Really?
No, it's not. And it also wouldn't necessarily be your fault unless you tripped them over. And I'm hoping that you're not going to do that.
Well, no, you're on the other side of the desk from me and I have trouble reaching you from here, Julia.
I feel fairly safe today. but you're right. I mean, there's no reason why a blind person would be hurt more than anybody else if they have a fall. They just need to get up and dust themselves off and keep moving. And the worst, I mean, you would hope that if anyone falls over, someone's going to say, oh, are you okay? Because that's a nice thing to do, isn't it? But we don't need to make such a fuss of it. Oh, my goodness, because it just makes the blind person feel more embarrassed. And to be honest, a blind person is more likely to fall over if a sighted person's done something stupid, like got in the way of their cane because they're too busy looking at their mobile phone when they're walking down the street, or if a sighted person... Like my most unfavourite thing is catching buses and trains when the school kids are on the buses and trains, because the first thing they do, get on the train and chuck their bag down on the ground, usually in the aisle, and you have an aisle full of school bags to navigate with your white cane. That's more dangerous than anything else. So we're not a danger. It's the sighted people that are a danger to us.
You sound like you really enjoyed primary school. How was high school for you?
High school was a different kettle of fish for me. My parents made the really difficult decision to put me back into the state special education system. There was an intention that I would go to my local private high school. And while the school was very keen to have me with them, the education department at the time said that if I went to a non-government school, I would receive no resources, no braille machine, no books, no support. This was the decision that was made. And while the school was very prepared to sink a lot of money into my education, they very rightly and wisely could not guarantee that I wouldn't suffer academically. And because my parents believed, again, very rightly, that education is the silver bullet, they felt that the best decision was to send me to a state school that had, as part of it, a special education unit where there were about 25 to 30 other blind students studying at the school.
What happened on your first day?
I can remember it like it was yesterday. I can tell you the room we were in. I can tell you the building number, the block number. I can tell you what was on the floor. I can tell you how it smelt. I was on someone's arm, and I have to be honest and say I don't remember the girl's name. And quite reasonably, she took me to the teacher and said, Miss, I was Julie back then. I'm Julianne now, reinvented myself as we do. I've got Julie here, Miss, and she's blind. And the teacher said, okay, well, put her behind a desk like everybody else. And that's a fair response. It's an absolutely fair response. This teacher was trying very hard to make me just part of the group. The problem with integrating a group of blind children into a larger group of sighted children is that we become a thing of alarm. We become a thing of concern to the sighted children. And for some of us, particularly the girls, we became a thing of ridicule and we became people to be bullied and we had targets on us pretty much from the beginning. Children weren't made aware the way they are now. There wasn't the same sort of education that there is now surrounding disability. When we send children into school environments now, we take a lot of time to give the other students a chance to talk about that disability, ask all their questions, get all their concerns out in the open. We didn't do that back then.
Was this bullying physical as well as verbal? Would you be pushed around?
Mostly it was verbal. There was physical bullying in the sense of being left places. My mobility skills, while they were good, my anxiety was very high. And if you have high anxiety, you can't function very well. So I would be taken somewhere and left there, and I'd have to find my way back. We weren't using white canes at school either. We weren't encouraged to do that. I'd have a Perkins brailer in one hand, a very, very large school bag on my shoulder. And I'm not a very tall person, and I don't have a very broad stature. And when I was at school, I was really small. And I was trying to navigate through a school full of fairly old buildings with a Perkins braille machine, you know, no white cane. It was very difficult.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
How were you expected to get around your school, Julianne?
I really think I was expected to just do it by my wits. I really felt like I needed to be MacGyver, you know, I needed a paperclip and a rubber band or something. It was a very difficult environment for me. The problem was that the other blind people who were in the environment didn't appear to find it so difficult. They didn't seem to have the same level of anxiety as I did. Therefore, I was the odd one out. Therefore, it was me that had the problem. But everybody was taller than me. Everybody was bigger than me, and everybody was faster than me. It was just frightening. And we don't tend to do it the same way now. We allow blind children to use their canes, or at least we should. We give them at least a weapon of mass destruction to move through the school grounds with.
What happened the day you asked for someone to follow you to make sure you didn't get lost from one end of the school ground to the other?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I always prided myself, and I still do, on being a person who is part of the solution, not part of the problem. You know those people that come at you and they've always got a problem but they can never solve it, and they just like to tell you what the problem is but they never have an answer? I try not to be that person. I try, if I've got an issue, to already have thought of what the solution is. And I had to get from the special education unit, which was at one end of the school, to ART, which was literally the last bastion of buildings before you reach the other end of the school. And I was just so frightened of doing this between classes. And I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I'll go to my teacher and I'll be really grown up and I'll be really sophisticated and I'll ask for help. I was all of 12. And I said, oh, miss, I've got to go to ART next, and I'm actually really wanting to be independent and I'm really wanting to travel by myself and I really want to be a mature and responsible student at school, but I'm feeling really anxious and I'm wondering if you would follow me. I don't need you to talk to me, but if you could follow me to make sure I get there safely. And she said, no, off you go. And I remember standing with tears, just those silent, terrified tears that run down your face when you're just so deathly, deathly frightened of something. And I begged her. I said, please. And she said, if you're late, you'll get into trouble.
Why would she say that?
Because there's, and it still exists today, there's a form of teaching that says, if we're tough on you, the world can't be any tougher. Quite frankly, I think that this particular incident illustrates what I call the cop-out style of teaching. It absolves the teacher of any responsibility for the student. I had come with now what we would say was a child showing initiative, a child genuinely wanting to learn, knowing their weaknesses and asking for assistance. And we would now say, wow, well done you for wanting to do that by yourself. Of course, I'll follow you. And we would probably do it in a series of graded steps. So today you would follow a few steps behind. Tomorrow you would follow at a distance. And the next time you might say, hey, you go and I'll meet you there. And now, of course, we have the ability with mobile phones and all sorts of things to be able to say, hey, you go to class, send me a text when you get there. So we now provide kids with that scaffolding. Well, good teachers were doing that all the time, and good teachers are now doing that these days.
But the environment you grew up in, it sounds like it's either the world was trying to either put you in cotton wool or tough it out, suck it up, girl, and get on without any help at all.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that could change from day to day, and it could change from person to person.
You were doing music. That was a big part of your life.
Yes, it still is.
How do you read music?
I read Braille music. So
there is such a thing?
Yes, there is. Yes, there is. Music consists on a staff. So you have five lines and four spaces. And printed music is very pictorial. You know, even for people who can't read music, they would see it as little pictures. Braille isn't pictorial. So we have to develop a code of symbols to equal the note. So we don't think of middle C, for example, as resting between the two staffs, the bass and treble staff. We think of it as being fourth octave C, because it's the fourth C along on the piano. So we talk in octaves, not staffs and lines and spaces. The interesting thing is, though, that you've got to have a certain ability to hold multiple ideas in your head at once when you use Braille, because a C eighth note or quaver, this will mean something to musicians, is a Braille letter D. That letter D, when it's in conjunction with another sign, is the number four. So you've got to be able to contextualise what you're reading to work out what the symbols mean. So you can imagine that teaching Braille and then Braille music to someone with less than average intelligence can be really, really difficult.
Manners. How important were manners for you growing up? Quite often when I've met disabled people, they often have had to develop quite a gregarious personality to put people at their ease.
Okay.
and good and really lovely manners as well. Were you brought up with really good manners? Like
absolutely.
That?
I think I had to have better manners than my siblings. I don't think I was ever allowed to get away with anything, and I'm grateful for that. I was taught at a very young age to shake hands with people. I was taught, even though I can't look at someone, it was always insisted upon that I make sure that I'm engaging with that person physically, so I'm facing in their direction, my head's up, I'm very much engaging with the person and what they're saying, and I was still taught that even though I can't make eye contact, it would be rude for me to turn the other way if you were speaking to me. So those things were drilled into me by my parents and also by my teachers, and I think that often people with a disability are expected to have better manners than people who don't. Because if we don't, it's like, oh, that poor blind child, no one's ever taught her. It's possible that I'm just a little terror, you know. It's got nothing to do with my blindness. Perhaps I'm just horrible.
Of course. But, you know, the thing is, I think most people feel a degree of anxiety encountering a blind person. And so if you then immediately go on the front foot and you show really lovely manners, then straight away the sighted person feels reassured. And we're suddenly running, our conversation is running on railroad tracks of familiarity.
Yes,
so
that's right.
That means you can avoid a whole lot of crap then, doesn't it, I suppose?
It does. If people pick up on that very quickly, it's wonderful. And sometimes it still takes people a while. So I might have had a very, you know, intellectual conversation about something with them, and then they might still say to me, who helps you get dressed in the morning? And that does tend to put the conversation into a whole nother zone, because nobody, you know, I do all those things myself, because this is not a deficit that I have.
Is it easy to get away from rude people? Because, you know, if you run into a rude person at a party, you can say, well, I'm just going to go and stand over here for a while. I don't care for your company very much. But
it's easier now that I have flash sonar and I'm happy to use my cane and navigate. It can be difficult because they follow you. They really, you can be quite a target. You can also be a target for the shy and lonely people, because, and that's fine. I'm happy to do my bit. But you can be a target for the socially awkward people, because they think that you're going to be a socially awkward person too, so they're going to gravitate towards you. And I don't think that anyone has ever described me as being socially awkward. So they're not the people. I want to be at the cool table, please.
Yeah, you don't want to always be at the sad and socially alienated table.
No, no. And so I will often make excuses to go to the cool table.
And how do you ascertain the cool table?
You can hear the cool table.
And what's the cool table? It's not like they're dressed in, clearly.
No, they're laughing. Sometimes the cool table is the table of people that are using not small words for me. I like people that are having a decent conversation and using words of more than two syllables. That's my prejudice coming out, I suppose. I've got a little bit of an educational bias there, an intelligence bias, if you will. You talk about people judging people from what they see on the television and looking at a person and making a judgment about them. I will make a judgment about someone based on the way they speak. And heaven help that poor person if they're not articulate, because I've already decided that they're the village idiot. And that isn't fair, because, you know, there are very smart people who are not necessarily articulate, and it isn't fair of me to make that judgment.
Are you telling me you're just as prone to snap prejudice as the sighted people are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I pretend to be this blind, innocent angel, but really, it's not the case.
At some point, someone has to introduce you, I suppose, the sighted people, about personal appearance and why that's important to sighted people and fashion and all those things. Were you sort of given the bad news about all that at some point?
I always liked it. I was the little girl who carried mum's handbag and wore mum's heels. So I still engaged in all of those
things.
Really? Yeah.
Why on earth would a woman want to wear heels?
I don't know. It was an insane thing and I don't do it anymore. I've grown out of that, which is a good thing. But for me, you'd hear the clicking sounds of people's shoes, and that was pretty interesting, and I wanted to make that sound. And you know what? I probably wanted to make that sound until I was about 40, and then I saw the light, and I don't want to do that anymore. But I wanted to have a handbag like my mum. I wanted to have a purse. I wanted to have all of those things. And I'm still the sort of person who really does care about how they look and how they present. Makeup is really important to me. Clothes are really important to me. I don't necessarily need to be on trend. I can't afford to be on trend. I'm a musician. But I like to be classic. I like to be a bit timeless, and I like to be absolutely appropriate. That is really important to me, to be appropriate.
For people who are sighted, you know, when you have that, you form an instant attraction, and often it's very quickly based on looks.
Yes.
How does hotness work for you, Julianne? How do you judge a person as being hot?
The sound of someone's voice, the way that you touch them, the way they touch you, touch is so important to me.
And what's required there? Gentleness?
Gentleness, consideration. You know, people with disabilities, like the elderly and like small children, we call it, you know, the rest of the world has a very polite disregard for our personal space. You know, I often see on my Facebook feed, you know, really able blind friends of mine saying, I got accosted on the train again today. You know, this man tried to lift me and take me to a seat. And this poor girl is being lifted by this man whom she did not know. And she says to him things like, you know, this, you know, you're really not my type. I don't want to go out with you. Please put me down. But there is that real polite disregard for our personal space. So when somebody doesn't do that, immediately I think, okay, you might be nice. And then if they have a nice voice, that's a really big turn on.
Can that make you go a bit crazy too, the way that sighted people do? You see an attractive person, you go, oh, you get a little bit discombobulated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For me, if I hear a voice, I can lose my complete train of thought and become a stupid person.
Wow. Really?
Yes, really.
You don't need looks for that at all?
No. Wow. Oh, goodness, no. Goodness. I mean, I don't know if it's the same for men, but I know women can relate. I mean, you don't have to see Barry White, you know, to listen to him on the record to have a little bit of a moment. And I'm sure that it's the same for most sighted women. They can be affected by a voice. I don't know about men. I don't know if women's voices affect men in the same way, but they sure do affect women.
Yeah, I'm just speaking up on behalf of us shallow men at the moment. That's what I'm doing here. That's if you didn't know. Tell me how you met your husband.
We were at university together. We'd been there for several years and I'd known him around the traps. But in my final year at university, we were going to the music ball, which was our final ball, and I was wearing a green dress. It was a size 8. I had dieted to fit into it. It was a big deal. I was eating and he kept coming up to me every time I was eating and asking me to dance. And I'm like, hello, I'm eating. Just go away. And he did this like at every course. And I'm thinking, you're really slow. You are not getting this at all. And then finally he came up to me and I was standing with friends and he said, you've got nothing in your hands. You're not eating. Will you dance with me? And I said, sure. And so off I went and stepped into his arms. And that was really the beginning of our love affair, I suppose. And we've been married now for going on 21 years.
Oh, it wasn't the voice in this case. It was the touch.
Voice, the touch, the way he was. His persistence went a fair way as well. He was pretty persistent. He's a very gentle, thoughtful man who has always tried to always allow me to be the most that I can be. And that is the greatest gift that anyone can give me, really.
How did you become aware of a man called Daniel Kish and his extraordinary work in developing this whole idea of echolocation?
In December of 2010, I was channel surfing on my holidays, as you do, and just flicking through, and I heard the words retinoblastoma. I should confess now that I am a medical TV junkie. Love it, love it, love it. The gorier the better. I can't see it. My kids come in and go, oh, mum, turn it off. But I love medical television. So when I heard retinoblastoma, I went, ooh, yes, please. And I'm watching this story about this young boy from Sacramento who had had retinoblastoma, had lost his eyes and was clicking. And he was blind and he was clicking and he was skateboarding and he was playing basketball and he was very, very active. And I thought, well, that's fine. Nothing like me at all. He was not, you know, he didn't appear to be academic or bookish. I didn't relate to this boy at all. But then as part of the construct of the documentary, they got Daniel Kish to come and work with this boy because his mother was very concerned because he wouldn't use a long cane. He didn't think he needed to. And then here was this man who I could really relate to. He was extremely articulate. You could tell by the way that he spoke, he was very intelligent. So already my prejudice had kicked in. I went, yep, like you. And he was blind. He'd also lost his eyes to retinoblastoma, you know, before he was 15 months old. He had both eyes removed. And he was travelling around the world completely by himself. And I thought, oh, there's going to be some caveat here, you know, this isn't really what it is. But it really was what they said it was. And I remember my heart raced and my hands got sweaty and I thought, there's something in this for me. There's something I need to know. There's something I need to learn. And it was exciting, but it was also confronting because it asked me to challenge the construct I'd created for my life and to change it.
What happened then?
I Googled him, which is what we all do. And I emailed him and said, do you ever come to Australia? And within hours of that email, he had emailed me back. We'd gotten in touch by Skype. I had to learn how to use Skype, but I did that. I became very technological and we communicated by Skype and I was so thrilled to be communicating with a man I'd just seen on a BBC documentary. And he started talking to me about what he did. And there were a lot of tears on my end because it was very, very difficult to contemplate that I'd been missing out on this all this time. And I raised funds and got him to come to Australia and to work with me. And so I had him work with some children around Queensland when he came to Australia.
Yeah, what about you though? How did he train you?
8 days of echolocation training, which was a lot, but I was prepared to pay for it. The very first thing he did when he got off the plane, I said, would you like to have some rest? Would you like to have some relaxation? Thinking, please say yes, I'm really scared. And he said, no, let's do it. And he handed me a full-length cane. So we call it a full-length cane. Most people's long canes come up to about their sternum. That's the traditional length in Australia. World Access, we like to have our canes anywhere from our chin to the top of our forehead.
Why is that better?
Well, I'll ask you a question. If you have the option of knowing about a cliff, one step before you're going to fall off it or five steps, which option would you choose?
I'm going for option B, Julianne.
Nice. Option B. You win the prize, and the prize is that you won't fall off the cliff
right. Because
the cane gives you more preview.
So he gave you that, and was that straight away a noticeable difference?
Within 10 steps, because I went, I don't know about this, and within 10 steps I went, this is great. My walking speed increased before I did anything with flash sonar. My walking speed increased. I felt safer.
And then the clicking. How quickly did it take you to pick up this practice of echolocation?
So not only am I a teacher, but I'm a student and I like to research and I like to study. So, you know, in the year that it took for me to raise the money for Daniel to come out, I'd been practicing my click and I'd been reading everything that Daniel had ever written about the click. So I had the click sorted by the time he got here. He had to help me refine it because what I found was I could hear the click and not the echo. And he said to me, smile. And as soon as you smile, somehow the click comes out from you and you can hear the echo. And that's all he said was smile. And it changed everything, which is lovely.
How quickly did that take?
A few moments.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. A few moments for me. Different for everybody.
And was there a shift in your head once you could echolocate?
Yes. There was a sense of, I can really do this. And that was fine. We were walking around familiar areas. We were walking around my block and that was fine. It was when Daniel said, let's get on a bus and go to your local shops, that I didn't think it was a very good idea. And I thought we should take a sighted person with us. And Daniel was very adamant that we didn't need to do that. And I said, but you've never been there before. And he said, no, but you have. And together we got on the bus, went off to my local shops and found Target. And I had said, that's impossible. And when we got to Target, he looked at me and he said, I just want to remind you that you said that's impossible. And it really was possible. A lot of strategies, flash sonar, good long cane technique, good direction asking. You know, hello, if you don't know where you're going, ask somebody.
If I were blindfolded for a week,
yes,
Could I learn echolocation or as quickly as you?
You might be able, if you're very, very talented, to find a wall with a space in it, like a door kind of space, if you're very, very talented. And if you practice very, very hard, and if you didn't take your blindfold off at all, you might be able to do that. It's very different because we perceive things in a different way. And you're a sighted person, and until you stop being one, you're going to perceive and behave like one.
Daniel Kish says that most blind kids intuitively start clicking.
Yes.
They intuitively start doing it. Yeah. But then they stop. Why do they stop?
In Australia, blind children have routinely been told not to click because it's considered socially unacceptable to make that noise. Now, we're talking about...
Oh, my God.
We're talking about that noise. I think that is way less socially unacceptable than running over people with your cane and your body. I think that can be... Unless you really want to meet them, it's a good way of meeting people, but not always socially acceptable.
How has this changed your life now, this practice of echolocation?
Look, I do feel less anxious. I still have a little bit of anxiety. I've had a couple of accidents, one fairly serious accident since echolocating. I will point out that I had that accident while I was being guided, so I wasn't independently travelling when I had that accident. And so I've still got a bit of a ways to come back from that accident. But I felt pretty confident to follow you into the studio, although I did want to go and investigate all the other rooms in the ABC.
Yeah.
But I felt pretty confident to just follow you. I didn't feel worried if I wasn't hanging onto your arm. The lovely thing now, and this is what we try to get across, is now I have choice. So I do get the odd person who says, oh, you're using someone's arm. Oh, you're being guided. Oh, so everything you're saying is a fraud. No, I have a choice now. If I want to walk along with my girlfriend and have a chat to her, and it's easier for me to do that by having my hand on her arm so that we can have a nice intimate conversation, I'll do that. If I don't want to do that, if I'm in a place that I want to get out of, if I feel threatened, if I feel like I don't want to be here, I'll whip out my cane and off I'll go. So now I have what we call freedom.
It seems to me, for us, you know, I keep bringing Beth back to narcissistically to us in the sighted world. It seems like maybe the best thing we can do, it's not that hard really, we just have to be a little bit considerate and not make so much of a fuss.
Absolutely. I think it's about stepping back and observing a situation. Some of the best teachers of blind children are those teachers who are prepared to watch a situation play out before they intervene. And yeah, you know, I have a very dear friend who is probably the best vision impairment educator I have ever known, either as a teacher or as a colleague. And she will just stand back and observe. She's ready if she's needed, but she will observe, and 9 times out of 10, the situation will resolve itself. In Australia, we're very custodial. We want people to have, you know, who's looking after you? I'm 43. I'm looking after myself, is my answer.
You know, the late, great Stella Young used to perform on stage. She was a very funny comedian, apart from anything else. And she used to say, I don't want people come up to her, me, and she'd say, and people say, oh, you're so inspiring. And she'd say, I don't want to be your effing inspiration. Do you feel the same way?
I really do. I used to go to the gym, and I don't go to the gym anymore. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of the main reasons is because I'd be walking on a treadmill. So I'm standing there, I've got my hands on the bar and I'm walking on the treadmill, and people would come and they would touch me inappropriately. What I mean is without my knowledge, not completely inappropriately. And they would say, oh dear, you are so inspiring on that treadmill. We are just so blown away by what you can do. And I'm thinking, I'm walking on a treadmill. This is not a difficult thing. I mean, I have 2 legs. So for me, that's not difficult. It's much, you know, if I split the atom, if I climb Mount Everest, if I do something amazing, you know, if I find a cure for something, you know, horrible, please feel free to be inspired by me. I think that conducting a choir when you can't see is pretty cool. Don't know about inspiring. I think it's cool. But walking on a treadmill, there's really nothing inspirational about it for me.
I tell you what, inspiring or not inspiring, it's great fun to talk to you, Julianne. So enjoyed this conversation. And I wish we had another hour and a half. I've got another 100 questions I never got to ask you. Maybe I'll have to ask you to come back one day. Thank you so much, Julianne.
My great pleasure.
Julianne Bell is the Managing Director of World Access for the Blind Australia.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.